This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several generations of children have grown up on the books of artist Maurice Sendak, such as Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. He's won the top awards for children's books, but his work has quite an adult following, too. Sendak has also designed sets for several operas. His work for children has always had a dark edge, but nothing quite as dark as his latest work. It's a collaboration with writer Tony Kushner, who's best known for his play Angels in America. They've adapted a children's opera that was originally performed by the children in the Nazi concentration camp Terezin. The opera, Brundibar, is a parable about evil that was written in 1938 by a composer who was killed in the gas chambers. The English adaptation, with Kushner's libretto and Sendak's sets, was performed at the Chicago Opera this year. Excerpts will be performed Sunday at the 92nd Street Y in New York. A new book adaptation of Brundibar features Kushner's text with Sendak's illustrations. I asked Maurice Sendak why the children in the Nazi concentration camp performed the opera Brundibar.
This opera was written by Hans Krause, a very young Czech composer, and it was written for children, Jewish children, in an orphan asylum in Prague to amuse them. There was a contest who could write the prettiest opera for the children. And Krause wrote this, and everybody loved it. And at that very same point, the Nazis entered the country, and the orphanage was emptied, and the children were put into Terezin, the camp. And he was too, as was the librettist. And it became a show camp, became known as Hitler's favorite camp. He set it up in such a way and made a film of how well the Jews were being treated, and the gypsies, and the homosexuals. And this was too, because rumors were getting out that were frightful. And so he set this up to prove to the Red Cross and diplomats who were traveling the world to come by, see a show, and see how happy everybody was. And it's in the film. You see the children singing the last portion of the opera. So they all sat there. It was performed 55 times, a huge success, this little opera, which is about 45 minutes in length. That's the story. Hans Krause was murdered too, as was the librettist, as was, well, mostly everybody in the camp. It was an elitist camp. You had Bauhaus workers there, you had artists, people teaching the children there, intellects. It was a special camp. But so it ended the same way for all of them.
So the performances were for visiting diplomats to show off the camp?
Yeah.
Do you know if they fell for it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, they fell for it. The streets were cleaned, trees were planted, all the children were given clean clothes, all the inmates were given clean clothes, everything was swept up, and they went, and you had a pass. Quite an attractive pass, which I'd love to have an original of, but I've used as an image in the book, to get in to see Brundibar.
Tell us the story that's told in the opera that you tell in the book.
This was directly written for children, and the limitations of children. They don't have singing voices. Some of them do, but that was by accident. But mostly it's sort of like a Singspiel, which is like a Mozart opera, the Singspiel, where you talk over the music rather than actually sing. And those who could sing, sang. And the music is astonishing. He was in his 30s, so you hear Janáček and you hear Weill. And you hear Gershwin and you hear Ravel, and just like all of us young artists steal like crazy until we make ourselves up as artists, you hear all these wonderful sounds. And the story is ultra simple, so the children could follow it and produce the tale, which has to do with a little brother and sister whose mother is ill. And the doctor says unless they get milk for her, she won't last. So they go out into the world, which is, in my case, Prague, into the city proper, and please somebody give them money to buy milk for mommy, and nobody will. And in the streets of Prague, on a specific corner, is Brundibar, who is an organ grinder. Mean. In Czech, Brundibar means bee, like a bee sting. And he's taken over the whole place, and he sings, and people throw money in his hat, and the kids say, well, anybody could do that. So they stand on the other corner and they sing a dreadful song. And everyone just ignores them and they wonder why they can't do this. And they stay all night in the street by themselves, and a cat and a bird and a dog come to their assistance and say, look, let's pull this together, because the two of you can't do this by yourselves. let's get all the kids in town. Let's get all the kids in town. And in the morning, there's this beautiful music. The children wake up, and they're getting ready to go to school and comb their hair and wash dishes and such. And the animals convince them to come and help these kids. So they all come to the town square, 300 of them. And they say to Brundibar, we want to sing, and we don't care about money. We just want to sing. And Brundibar says, no, get the hell out of here. And then the townspeople say, oh, let the kids do it. And they sing a lullaby, which is like extraordinary to hear it. And people are captivated, and they fill their milk can with coins. They've made it. They have enough money now. But Brundibar sneaks in, grabs the can, rushes off and steals their money. And the whole town chases Brundibar, and they catch him, and they beat him up. And the kids get their money back and buy the milk, come home triumphant, and save their mama. And that's the story.
But there's an epilogue to the story. There's a little poem at the end. Could you read that for us?
Sure.
And just, you know, reminder, this is written while Hitler is coming to power.
Exactly. And the fact that it is impossible for me to doubt that the children knew what their fate was. Imagine standing up on the stage and singing about brotherhood, and if we all hang together, we're going to succeed, and the bully will not. And knowing that as soon as this audience left, kaput, their lives are finished. I can't even grasp that now. I've been studying, working on this for over 3 years. So in this, I wanted my cake and eat it too, because they do save their mother. But evil will persist as the world goes on, and they have to know that, whether their parents like them to know it or not. Okay, so we're just turning the page on the big happy ending where everything is wonderful and safe and mommy is alive. And then there's a little coda at the end, which was written by Tony, basically. It's not in the opera. And it says, this is Brundibar talking, they believe they've won the fight. They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. Love, Brundibar.
Yeah, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah, kind of chilling.
Chilling epilogue.
Yeah.
So Tony Kushner wrote that for the book.
He wrote that, yeah. We had to, because we had to take into account two things. One, this is a book for children, as it was an opera for children. So obviously the parents have an option of reading this epilogue to their kids or not.
Right.
But my faith in children is that they know this. How can you live in America and not know everything? So the towers fall down. Now we know that something else has to happen. We've warned over and over. It's like this.
How do you think the paintings and drawings that you did for the new book, which is a kind of Holocaust fairy tale, mm-hmm. how do those compare with the classic books that you did, like Where the Wild Things Are and Outside Over There?
This is strange to say, more personal. Where the Wild Things Are and Outside Over There. And
In the Night Kitchen?
Yeah, The Night Kitchen are all books that came from my original creative soul, self, whatever, that have no conscious connection to events in my life. And I just think of them as terrific inventions that came upon me and dominated my life until I finished them. This, which is, takes the form almost of a grim fairy tale, actually. It's a little Hansel and Gretel story over and over and over again. All those stories work for children. But this had such personal import. I've been carrying this around since childhood and frankly wanting to rid myself of it. The Holocaust and memories of childhood and my parents suffering and no childhood. There was no such thing as childhood. You know, I was born early. The Wall Street crash. My father always blamed me for the Wall Street crash. Thought he was endowing me with great strength for a one-year-old, but he was a very reasonable man, so he probably believed it. And then right after that, well, he lost all his money in his little tailor shop and. And then the war began. And I think mostly the point of the marriage of my mother and father was that you had to have a partnership. If you're a young immigrant who spoke no English, who'd just come over on the boat, And she got together as two partners, whether love was involved in it, maybe if you were lucky, maybe not. But the point was to pool your money and bring everybody over as fast as you can, because most of them knew what was going on and what was about to happen. So it began with my mother's family, and she got her mother, and she got two sisters and a brother missing, the same amount of sisters and brothers that she never got over. My father got no one, because by the time they got to my father, it was way too late to get anybody.
When did they come here?
My parents came just before World War I.
I think you were in high school during World War II.
Yes.
What was the first you actually heard of the death camps?
Early, because my father belonged to, it's called the Lobzer Branch, it was like a union. And this union kept track of what was going on in Europe to the various villages and townships. They got their information, I have no idea how. And they kept my father and his buddies informed as to what was going on in their township. And they presented him after the war with a book, which I treasure, of all the villages that were destroyed and the names of the people in the villages. And his village was in the book, and photographs of the town square and the death of his whole family. And that would have been before my bar mitzvah. I would have been between 10 and 12. What I knew what was going on, and unhappily reminded endlessly of my good fortune. And if I came up late for dinner, my mother howling from the window, and I'd be here about Leo and Benjamin and the other children who were my age who could never come up for supper and were good to their mothers, but now they were dead, and I was lucky. And
oh, yeah. Rule out any pleasure in your life, huh?
You were in mourning all the time.
All right.
And the sad thing is that when you're a kid, you're naturally supposed to not to be boarding and have fun. I hated them. I hated them because they blighted my life.
We hated who?
I hated them for dying.
Right.
Because all I brought was violent scenes in the house between my mother and father, and her pulling hair out of her head, my father diving onto the bed, and these vivid memories.
Your classic books are kind of like children's fantasies, you know, positive ones, scary ones, but the new book, Brenda Barr, it's a Holocaust parable.
Well, yes, and it's not original with me.
Right, right. So you know, the Holocaust is going to have influenced, I'm sure, the way you drew and painted the characters and the animals and the streets. So can you talk about how you drew them and how that compares to the characters of your earlier books?
The characters of my earlier books are really only sort of cockamamie self-portraits. I mean, unfortunately, I look like Max and the Wild Things. as children will tell you in their brazen way, oh, Mommy, he looks like the Moisha, the big wild thing. You know, you just want to crack them. These children are European children. They are pretty much based, I did a lot of research on Polish children's books, Czech children's books of the 30s, and like the cover of this book and the whole quality of the printing and the composition is my effort to make this look like a little folk tale from a foreign country. And I've seen older people pick this up and say, oh my goodness, there's so much like I read when I was a child. And that's what I wanted to hear. And so I definitely was shifting away from my frenzied and feverish head and getting to regular kids who are nothing like my life at all. But I knew their lives. I had imagined their lives. But they come from little villages where there's a village church, and then when they get to Prague, there's the synagogue. The last picture in the book, assuming that these two kids are Jewish kids, and that's why they have suffered so much, when they get home to the mother's house and they provide the milk, and the doctor leaves, who is Jewish, and he says, Mazel Tov, he's so happy for them. There's a huge crucifix on the wall. And people say, Maurice, I say, but they're not Jewish. No one said they were Jewish. They're just kids whose lives are wrecked by being kids in the wrong place. They're in Europe. That's all. And the Holocaust affected everybody.
What about the animals in the book? Because the animals help the children.
Yeah.
And so they're very animal-like and kind of human-like in a
yes,
way, too.
Yes, yes. Well, I was influenced, too, by the, in the opera, you had to have three kids dressed as animals. And they're talking animals and snotty animals at times. I must tell you this. I met a woman. I did a design for a ballet with Palabolas. And that was at the very beginning of getting involved in this. And that was a Holocaust ballet. It was very dark. And the Palabolas people were a little troubled by it. But anyway, when it was done, it was performed at the Joyce Theater. And I was there with the crew and Tony. And this woman came up to me. She had to be around my age. And crying. And she put her arms around me and asked me if I was who I was. And was it true that I was going to do Burn the Bar? She had read it. I said yes. And she just like fell apart. She said, I was in the production. I was in the opening night production. My name is Ella Weisberger. And I played the cat when I was a 10-year-old girl.
Wow.
And she produced photographs. And so she and I have become, as you can imagine, fast friends. And she told me much about the opening production and what life was in the camp. And how did she make it? How did she get out? She was freed by the Soviets when they came in and took over. She was still living. And she was one of 11 girls who survived out of, I don't know how many, maybe 20 to 40,000 children were murdered there. She's one of 11.
Wow.
And she became so identified with this work. And we were sitting at the rehearsal hall in Chicago, me sitting next to her, and suddenly the little girl who was playing the cat, who's 10-year-old, just as she was, kind of tripping out on the stage with her arms stretched out, looking, do I look good in my costume? And we just died. I mean, time suddenly crunched up. We were right in the time machine. Here was Ella, there's a new 10-year-old, there's me having lived through this in America, and the combination was too much. It was really too much. But she loved it, and she provided me with lots of information.
Well, you mentioned what it was like for you to see this 10-year-old girl come out in her costume.
Yeah.
Did you design the costume
yes,
for her?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
was she wearing?
It was a combination of black tights, with sort of a max head with two ears sticking up, all black, with a beautiful long tail, her haunches packed so she looked like a cat when it arches its back. She was wonderful. She also had a great voice, and she was like Mata Hari. I mean, she was very seductive in her role. Whereas a photograph of Ella, which is in many books, there's a cast photo, which comes from the last scene in the movie that Hitler's favorite camp. Ella was a tall, strapping girl with a stricken look on her face. And, well, you can make up anything you like from a photograph. But our cat, whom Ella loves, was the most charming young girl. All the children were splendid. But she spent time with them and told them what the story was that they were in, told them about the camp, showed her what she said was her mommy's star that she had to wear, and her mommy's passport, and she told them everything.
How did they react?
If I could only determine that from the way they performed, they reacted. Children are tough. All they ask of you is the truth.
Yeah, but you know, you keep saying children are tough and everything, but look at how traumatized you've been from the
things.
Well,
nobody told me the truth, really.
You think that's what it was?
That was partly what it was. Nobody sits down really with children, and I don't think anybody told me anything as much as I picked up everything. Also, I had an older sister and an older brother, and they could keep me informed in their way. But this was not direct information from my parents. Do parents sit down and tell their kids everything? I don't know. I do. Because I've convinced myself, I hope I'm right, that children despair of you if you don't tell them the truth.
You're not their parent, though.
I'm not their parent.
Yeah.
But when they write to me and they treat me through my books and my relationship with them, it's intensely private. I have been with them in their bedroom for a good part of their childhood. They have written to me. They trust me in a way, I dare say, possibly more than they trust their parents. I'm not going to bullshit them. I'm just not. And if they don't like what they hear, that's tough bananas.
What were the stories or the fairy tales that had the biggest effect on you when you were young?
My father's stories. My father's a great storyteller.
Did he tell you stories about his life or
yes.
fairy tales his and classic stories?
No, not fairy tales. I mean, he told memory stories, which they call me the dark man of children's. I guess I got it from him, but he would tell us stories that would put us to sleep. My sister, brother, and I shared the same room, and he would sit cross-legged on the floor or bring a chair in, and he would tell us shtetl stories. I mean, stories. You want an example of
sure.
of why I am have been an insomniac all my life? Here's a story, which was one of my favorites. I wanted to hear it over and over again, how the children of his shtetl got together. And there was a contest, just the boys, of who could run furthest into the cemetery in the middle of the night. And how do you prove that you ran furthest? Because you had a stick, and you put the stick down. And the morning you found out whose stick had gone furthest. Well, he was doing this with his friend, and they all ran a certain distance, and they couldn't see each other. And he heard this horrible screaming from one of his friends. Horrible screaming. And instead of going to help him, they all ran home. And in the morning, they found him dead. And what he had done, because they wore these long shifts, he put the stick in, and it went through his own shift. And it went in the ground, and he thought the dead man was pulling him in. Because his screams were all to do, the dead man is taking me, the dead man is taking me. And they thought he was just hysterical. But he thought somebody had reached in and was pulling him into the grave. Huh. That was one of his stories. My favorite, actually.
Oh, gosh. And then they can't reassure you and say, but honey, it's just a story.
No.
Because it was true.
Because it happened.
Right.
Because it happened. I'd much rather have known that it happened. I was in the unfortunate position of causing a child's death when I was a child.
What happened?
And we lived in Brooklyn, and there were these big, ugly houses, and there were these narrow alleys between each apartment house where we played ball, where the clotheslines hung. And I was playing with Lloydie. How could I forget his name? His name was Lloyd, but we called him Lloydie. And we were throwing a ball to each other, and I was at the far end, and he was facing the street. And I had this ball, and I threw it very hard, and it went over his head, and it ran into the street, and he chased it. And next I saw him flying, hit by a car. He was killed.
Oh.
And I ran home, and I stayed at the house. And I thought I'd never come out of the house because his mother would kill me. And how could I ever go on living? And my mother was very worried, and because I would not go out of the house. And I don't know how it all came about, but they worked it out that I was come down into the street and sit on the stoop, and Lloydie's mother and his little sister would come and talk to me. And I wouldn't go down unless she would forgive me somehow. And I remember sitting on the stoop. I must have been 6, 7, something like that. And I still see her face and his little sister, and they came over to me, and she put her hand on my hand, and she said, I don't remember what she said. She comforted me that this was an accident, that it's a terrible, terrible accident. And it was bad enough to lose her little boy without me going down the drink. So look, I knew that. I'd done that. I've never forgotten that I'd done that. I cost him his life. And yet it was a normal accident. Kids playing in the street, they're always hit by cars or whatever. But imagine doing that and knowing that and being aware of those over there. That's a hell of a childhood.
I know a lot of this has come out like in your work as an artist.
Yeah.
But if it's not too intrusive, have you been in therapy over the years too?
God,
it goes
yes.
without saying, huh?
Hello. Of course. I can hold myself together. Till I left the nest and I got uptown, and everyone said, oh, you're so talented and you're going to get a book. And you're gonna... Of course, nothing happened as soon as I wanted it to. And then I did get a job. I worked at FAO Schwarz in the window. I did window displays and uh-huh. I painted things and stuff. And then I keeled over. I just really ran out of steam. I was too frightened. I just lost it. And a very good friend of mine then paid for my first session. He said, you have to help yourself. And I went, and I stayed for 10 years. Did it help me? I think it must have. But if I'd known that if I could just hang on to 75, I was going to be really okay. But nobody told me that with any luck, you get better as you age and the suffering decreases.
Does it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People say, what age would you rather be at? Anywhere between 55 and 65. I don't dare go to 50.
Huh. Why?
Because it's horrible. I know there are supposedly happy people in this world. I never believed it, but I take it for granted. God, those are all on television.
Okay, but I got to ask you, how much of that do you think is, is like growing up in the shadow of the Holocaust and having these horrible stories about, deaths
it's
of friends?
That, but that's
and
not
how much
all of it.
How much of it is just, do you think, like the chemistry of,
of
you?
Of course, there's been a lot of mental problems in the family. A lot of it could be genetic.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was seriously depressed. My sister suffers from depression. And so it was, and my mother was always depressed. So
without knowing it, right?
Without knowing it.
Because there's no such word for it. Your parents would not have known the word for depression.
If you asked her what was troubling her, she'd burst into tears and say,
nothing.
The whole life, bad children.
Right.
She would find a reason. Would find a reason for it. But no, she didn't know how bad off. We didn't know how bad off she was. We treated her quite badly because she was an appropriate mama.
If you don't mind my asking, we've talked about how the Holocaust affected you and how it, being Jewish, mm-hmm. branded you in a way. And do you think of yourself, I know you feel very defined in some way by being Jewish.
Yes.
Are you secular Jewish or are you observant?
Total secular.
Total secular.
I love being Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I love the bits of it that I love the candles. I especially love the memory of the dead, the little yahrzeit that you put out.
The candles, the 24-hour candle.
The 24 hours, yeah. But other than that, nothing. I am not a religious person. Nor do I have any regrets. The war took care of that for me. I was brought up strictly kosher, but it made no sense to me. Made no sense to me what was happening. So nothing of it means anything to me, nothing, except these few little trivial things that related to being Jewish.
Do you ever wish that you had faith?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't need it. I don't believe in that. Faith is, you know who my gods are, who I believe in fervently?
Oh.
Herman Melville, Emily Dickinson, she's probably the top. Mozart. Shakespeare, Keats. These are wonderful gods who've gotten me through the narrow straits of life.
I'm going to end on a really trivial note.
Okay. Is that all I deserve?
No, but that is what I'm going to end on, which is this. Your paintings and illustrations and glorious colors. And,
thank you.
And you're wearing a gray sweater today. Do you like color on your clothes or personal adornments of color? Or is that like just totally not relevant to you?
Totally. Well, everyone who knows me complains.
Of what?
Of how drably I dress, how innocuously, stupidly, and boringly. I don't buy clothes. I don't buy clothes. I hate to buy clothes. Color on me, heavens for fans. No way. men wear pink shirts and I'm very traditional, I'm very Brooklyn, I'm very middle class, I'm very embarrassed about the way I look, and I think if I dress sloppy and gray like I am now, that I won't be noticed. Hey, I don't have a strong self-image. And when kids say, oh, you look just like the Wild Things, that doesn't help. Just doesn't make it for me. That's not trivial, that's heartbreaking.
It's funny, too.
It's funny. Everything is funny, too.
Maury Sendak, thank you very, very much.
Oh, well, thank you. I so enjoy being with you.
Maurice Sendak's new book, Brundibar, is based on the children's opera of the same name, first performed by the children in the Nazi concentration camp Terezin. A collection of his work since 1980, called The Art of Maurice Sendak, will be published later this year.